Welcome to a brand new episode of Look Forward for week of March 6th. I'm your host, Jay. This is a solo episode this week, so it's just me, but I will still be giving the same level of political talk and information that you are used to from last week as well. Okay, so before we get started, a couple of things. This show is obviously only the free portion of this weekly show, so make sure you go to lookforwardshow.com and sign up for our premium membership. It's $5 a month or $50 for the full year. That also gives you access to all of the premium shows in the Nerdpocalypse Network. So make sure you go check that out and sign up. We really appreciate it. Also, feel free to leave a 5-star review on iTunes for this show. And if it's as long as it's a 5-star review, we will read it on air. Anything else, you know, we'll take, but we won't read it on air. Okay. All right. So let's get right into it. First up this week is a very interesting story from the DOJ, the Department of Justice, has basically released information about a report that they had been working on for the last 6 months on Ferguson, Missouri specifically. Now, obviously, Ferguson, Missouri is a hot button issue because of the shooting death of Michael Brown and the racial implications of that and what have you over the last couple of months. So the Department of Justice had Eric Holder, who runs the DOJ, had made some pretty open statements and criticisms of the way the police department was handling protesters and handling the investigation of Michael Brown's death. But that clearly wasn't the end of that. It wasn't just for show. Since then, they have done, the DOJ has done an extensive report that took a number of months that actually they collected 35,000 pages of police records and analyzed the race data compiled for every police stop in Ferguson, Missouri, which is amazing. And they also conducted hundreds of personal interviews as well with citizens of that area. What they did find is, obviously, Ferguson is 2/3 black, 1/3 white. But the crime statistics don't really bear that out as you might imagine they should. So apparently 85% of traffic stops, 90% of tickets, and 93% of arrests in Ferguson were all black. So disproportionately higher than the population even demands. And black folks also accounted for 95% of all arrests in Ferguson, period. So that goes to a larger issue that had been talked about for a while by the citizens of Ferguson and even some police in Ferguson who had sort of come out about the racial issues, not even just in Ferguson, but nationwide, that largely these police organizations are promoting a culture of racism. So the Department of Justice is basically saying, listen, you can either admit that these things are happening and in basically an open court and to the public and work to fix them, go to training and stuff like that, or we will sue you for constitutional violations against black people in Ferguson, Missouri. Now, some would make the argument that they're just doing this because it's a hot button issue and, you know, it's, I don't know, liberal payback against the police or some such argument. But the problem is that doesn't really hold water because the Department of Justice has in fact opened, I believe, 20 other cases like this around, 20 such investigations of local police departments for on the same grounds in places like Newark, New Jersey, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Cleveland, Ohio. So it's not just the ones that you're hearing about on the news, but rather the, you know, a systemic issue that the Department of Justice is trying to tackle. Now, what is tremendously interesting to me is you have the Department of Justice doing something that is seen as like, oh, it might be seen as unprecedented, like, wow, they're really doing it. But this isn't unprecedented at all, because this is exactly what the Department of Justice did during the days after the passage of the civil rights movement, right? You had to go into these local municipalities and you had to force police you know, police departments to actually comply with the law, because it's a old boy network, and, you know, you don't have any diversity in cops. You don't have any level of diversity of thought. It's just the blue wall and the cops. It's the cops versus the citizens. In this case, you know, the majority white cops versus black citizens. So it isn't unprecedented. It is clearly happening all over the country. And look, this is something, these 20 investigations, I wasn't aware of. And I would argue probably most people aren't aware of them. So it's kind of nice to hear that the Department of Justice is actually fighting to level some bit of equality across the nation for black citizens. And look, it's not just black folks either. You know, in Ferguson, it's specifically black people, but Latinos are unbelievably treated poorly, as well as black folks in places like New York City, where, you know, stop and frisk happens, which is disproportionately towards Latin folks and black folks, even though there are tons of white people who don't get pulled over, don't get stopped. And it's not because they don't commit crimes or have drugs on them, but there is an air that why bother pulling them over? Even though when white folks are pulled over, they are busted with more drugs than black folks, you know, proportionally. So, it is kind of interesting. I mean, they were talking about in this article, it's from the New York Times, which will be in the show notes, obviously, that even in November 2008, there was an email that a city official said, and this is in Ferguson, Missouri, that a city official said that Barack Obama would not be president long because, quote, what black man holds a steady job for 4 years? Another email included a cartoon depicting African Americans as monkeys, a classic. And a third described black women having abortions as a way to curb crime. These are inside of the power structure in Ferguson. These aren't emails sent from your racist uncle to your racist aunt. You know, these are city officials. These are cops. These are, you know, people running the police departments. That's a real problem. If they feel that they can send these things in the open like that, there is a culture that needs to be squelched. It needs to be pushed down of open bigotry and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, it is interesting, you know, Eric Holder actually made some comments about how he had a conversation with his son about the dangers of being a black man in America and how you can be pulled over or how you can be suspected for something, even if you did nothing, just solely based on the color of your skin. So it's kind of interesting that here is a person who is the top cop in the country. I mean, that's really his job. Even he understands that there is a level of unfairness, a level of mistreatment, a level of duress that these kids grow up in, and that black folks in general grow up in. So the fact that he sees that says a lot, and the fact that they're going after the power structure in Ferguson, I think, says a lot, and it should be applauded. One of the other things is, they don't have the ability to sort of push out, like, oh, they can't just fire the sheriff or something like that. They don't have that right. But what they can do is they can basically force them to do more minority police officer hires and things like that. Because once you mix those things up, they have a tendency to calm those things down. If you're working next to another cop who happens to not be your race, but they're going through the same things you are, it makes you a little bit maybe more understanding to them as a person, and hopefully that extrapolates out to the community, right? Maybe they actually live in the community, because that was one of the problems in the Ferguson case, is that 2/3 or more, I believe, of the cops in Ferguson don't live in Ferguson. So that's a real issue, and that creates a very us versus them mentality, or, you know, thought process. So hopefully the DOJ can limit that to some degree. There's a woman who's quoted here by saying that unless the cops in Ferguson are sued for, you know, basically civil rights violations, constitutional violations, they don't think it's going to change, quote, one iota. So, you know, take it for what it is. It's an unfortunate situation that it has even had to come to this, but it certainly is a real thing. So very interesting indeed. Okay, next up. So we talked last week pretty extensively about the issues going on in Wisconsin, the issues going on in Kansas. And so we're going to revisit Kansas a little bit because there is some more information that came out this week. So Sam Brownback, who is the governor of Kansas, basically has come out and is considering a possibility for expanding Medicaid, which would basically allow for an exchange to be a medical exchange to be set up for Obamacare in Kansas. Now, obviously, Sam Brownback is a fire-breathing conservative, right? He is a dye-in-the-wool conservative, and he hates any ideas of Obamacare, and he doesn't want to do it. But because he is such an unbelievably bad governor, and he has basically created a shortfall in their budget of $564 million, he is almost forced at this point to expand Medicaid so that he can bring in some federal money, because they'll get a lot of tax incentives and things like that and subsidies from the federal government, which is on purpose so that it entices states to actually expand Medicaid and bring in Obamacare, right? So basically right now he's not being forced per se, but it's making his life a little hard not doing it, right? And he's trying to scrounge up some money wherever he can. So there's a number of quotes here that I want to go through. So the first quote is all about how Kansas would try to make this work, right? How they would try to make the Medicaid funds work once if they expanded and brought in expanded Medicare and brought in Obamacare into Kansas. So the idea here is, quote, the plan, according to the Kansas KCUR, would use federal Medicaid funds to let adults with low incomes buy private insurance coverage. Most important, though, is that the proposal strikes a law passed by conservative Republicans that bar the governor of Kansas from expanding Medicaid without first getting legislative approval. So understand what that means. Basically, their idea, and I'm sorry, what I said before wasn't correct. So this is actually their plan to try to do without bringing in Obamacare, right? Or the ACA. So what this basically means is in Kansas, they have a law that says that you need to have basically the Kansas local Congress, right, or legislature, they need to approve any expansions of Medicare or Medicaid in the state. So Sam Brownback can't just unilaterally say, okay, it's expanded, let's do it, right? And at the same time, this legislature can't do the same. They can't just say, we're doing it without any regard to the governor, because they would if they could right now, because they need the money really badly. So their idea here is to do some sort of credit, which is a classic Republican move, right? It's, hey, let's figure out a way to, you know, give these people vouchers or credit so that they basically try to take the weight off of themselves and put it on the people trying to get medical care, right? We give you a credit for a certain amount of money a year, and we're going to go into an interesting story later on about how that's being used on a federal level as well by Republicans. But they give these credits and they say, okay, here's the credit. Let's say it's for $25,000 or $50,000. It's not even that high, but let's say just for a round number, they give you a credit for a certain amount. You are supposed to use that credit when you need to go and have a medical procedure done and things like that. And then anything above that credit you pay for, right? So it's a level of relief, and on its face, that sounds really good, right? Because you're spending the local state government is spending less money, but they're also helping people. So people feel like, oh, okay, this ain't bad. You know, look, you know, medical prices are, you know, medical payments and things are already astronomical, but because I'm getting this credit, it's not as bad. Where something like the Affordable Care Act actually would cover you at least the vast majority of any procedure, and there is no cap, but you just pay insurance like a reasonable adult. So this plan is flawed in about 18 different ways, but the overall move here is to make people feel good because you're giving them something and you're trying to give some level of relief to them. But in the end, it's all bullshit, and it's not really going to cover them nearly as much as they need to. Let's say you have cancer. Okay, let's say the credit is $25,000. Okay, $25,000 is a lot. Most people won't be spending $25,000 or, you know, what have you in medical insurance, right? Like, they're not going to, but some people will. And those people will continue to basically go bankrupt because they can't afford it. By the way, I'm just saying 25,000. That's not how much it actually is. There's no word. But there have been talks of credits very, very low, like maybe $10,000. And look, I'm getting ready to have shoulder surgery in a couple of weeks, and I found out that that's going to cost $12,000. So it's, and luckily I have great insurance, so I'm fine. But what if I only had a credit of $10,000? Not only do I have to come out of pocket $2,000, which is no little bit of money for the average American, it's not a little bit of money for me, you know, so I'd have to come out of pocket $2,000. And then on top of that, if anything goes on after that during the year, I don't have any money. So anything else is out of pocket. So it doesn't, the credit sounds really great on its face, but it doesn't match up with what actual reality is. And people get sick. People have to go to the emergency room. People fall down. People have kids. The kids break things all the time. Kids are always falling off of shit. So if you're talking about what a credit is, don't be fooled, because it sounds like coverage. It sounds like insurance, but it's coverage to a point. And that's the major part of it. It is just coverage to a point. If you understand nothing else. Now, what also is interesting, this article goes on to talk about how the red state model, which, you know, red states in the United States, is always a voucher program, right? But instead of actually trying something different like the ACA, which is actually working, they're willing to basically throw people under the bus even further just so that they don't have to pay any extra money. So there is a political science professor named Mark Peterson from Washburn University who gives a great quote. He says, quote, "Given that the state is not enjoying a robust economic recovery from the recession, and that the state coffers are depleted as they are, a lot of people are considering swallowing any cavils they may have about dealing with federal programs and federal oversight and embracing the idea that, quote, look, it's money. It's like a nest on the ground." So understand what he means here. This is at the heart of the issue, right? You screwed up so bad. You screwed your state up so bad with your trickle-down economics nonsense that you now have to accept this other thing that you never wanted to, that you railed against, that you ran against. But now you have to accept it in order to save your state. It's quite ironic. It's really quite ironic, because Sam Brownback was one of the biggest leaders talking about how his state is going to do so good, and they're going to cut taxes, and they're going to do so great, and they're going to protect their citizens, and we don't need Obamacare and all this other stuff. What happened now? What happened now? You ran your state into the goddamn ground because you don't know any better, and because you're an ideologue. You're not a statesman. You're an ideologue. Oh, we're supposed to cut taxes? All right, let's cut taxes. Ah, look, it's doing damage. Cut them further. It's going to turn around. Cut them further. Cut them further. Cut them further. You're an ideologue. So what you did was you destroyed your state and you put it into absolute peril. But the silver lining here is that maybe through your absolute incompetence, people will actually be able to get insurance. Maybe, just maybe. And that is amazing to me on a lot of ways. But sometimes there is a silver lining to people's unbelievable screw ups and incompetence. And this is a silver lining to Sam Brownback's incompetence. Okay, so next up is foreign policy. So let's take a look at what is happening. Obviously, there was a lot of conversations this week with the big speech from Benjamin Netanyahu, which we will get to, which I have plenty to say about. But I want to talk about the actual negotiations that are happening, right? That are happening in Switzerland. It is a huge deal, and I think it's much more important than the Netanyahu stuff, because I think people are actually paying attention more to the politics of things more than the actual policy of what's happening, right? So I want to talk about the policy, and then we'll get into the politics, because obviously they're interesting. So Iran currently is negotiating with six world powers, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Russia, and China. They are all aiming to create this framework of some level of negotiation to keep Iran from having nuclear material to create a weapon, and to also allow them to enrich uranium for nuclear power. That is something that is not talked about enough. They're not doing it just, I mean, they would argue. I mean, look, let's be real here. There is a significant wing of the Iranian government that does, in fact, support destabilizations in the region, that supports some level of terrorism sometimes. But those things, I don't want to get too heavy into, but I want to talk about exactly what is happening now. So, but just keep that in the back of your mind, because those things are true. Those are facts. So while they're doing this negotiation, a big part of the negotiation is something called a breakout period, right? So the idea here is the six powers want to set up a guarantee of sorts, right? As much as they possibly can. A guarantee of sorts that Iran will stay at least one full year away from having the amount of uranium in the facilities to enrich the uranium to a point of having a weapon, right? That's the best they can really ask for. I think it's about as realistic as you can be at this point. But they are enriching the uranium for the issues of cancer research in Iran, so they say, and for nuclear power, so they say, right? We have to take it with a grain of salt, obviously, but let's, for the sake of argument, let's say that that is true. And I think for the most part, it is true, to be honest. Why should they be denied the advancements of nuclear technology just because we said so, right? I mean, there's an argument to be made, well, they're dangerous, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I guess you could make that argument, but at the same time, you, in order to do a negotiation, you have to have some good faith involved. And right now, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get, they've gotten further in these negotiations than anyone has gotten in years. Back in 2004, there was a pretty decent plan that was put on the table. Dick Cheney fucking spiked it and said, we don't negotiate with evil. That's a fact. You can look it up. They spiked it because they didn't want peace. But they would rather saber rattle on both sides than to have actual peace. And it looks like for the first time in a long time, we might actually get back to 2004 situation where you might actually be able to get, you've gotten Iran to come to the table and sit down in Switzerland and talk this out and hash it out. And look, frankly, John Kerry is crushing it right now. He is doing such a good job and actually working the level of negotiation to try to make this happen with the other five major powers. So give him credit where credit is due. I don't always think that John Kerry is, I think he would have been the most boring president of all time, but I think he's a highly intelligent person, and I think he's highly capable. And clearly this is where he shines, and he's been doing a great job. So in recent weeks, people familiar with the negotiation talks have said that the big sticking point was the 12-month breakout period, like I talked about, which keeping them a year away from having nuclear material. Now, that had been such a back and forth that a lot of people thought that that was going to kill the negotiations, that Iran would never go for it. But apparently, some people are saying that it looks like Iran is shifting on this. And that's a good thing. Now, keep in mind, Iran has been suffering under huge and strenuous sanctions from the United States, as well as some of these major powers. I'm not sure all of them, but I think the vast majority of them, certainly the European powers. I know Russia and China tend to work a little well with Iran a little bit more, only because they sort of use them as a proxy, as a kind of a stick in the eye of the United States. So it is what it is, right? But so for the last couple of weeks, they've been trying to work this out. And if they are shifting on this, it's for one reason it's for two reasons. One is they want those sanctions lifted from the United States because they would like to not, because they're actually suffering economically. Like, the sanctions are working very well because they are crushing any imports coming into Iran from Europe. They're crushing any imports that come in from America, right? And exports as well. So that's part of it. The second part of it is, what is the other option here? War. And they don't want that. As much as people like to think, oh, you know, they like to rattle their sabers. They want to take on Israel. They want to take on the United States. No, they don't. No, they don't. You can just look right next door to Iran and see what a hellscape Iraq looks like after we come through. We are a broadsword. We're not a paring knife. If we come in, we're coming in and we're going to destroy everything. And that's because we're a total war country, right? Like, our militarism, good or bad, and that's not even, I'm not even making, you know, comments on whether it's good or bad. I tend to swing that it's bad, but we're not fucking around. And if we decide that we're going to go to war with somebody, it's not going to be half-hearted. And I don't think Iran wants that for its citizens. I don't think the Ayatollah wants that for his legacy. Not that I think he really cares about legacy. He's a tyrant anyway, but I don't think they want that. And I don't think the new president of Iran wants that either. So that goes to another point. If you're not aware of how Iran's political structure is set up, it's not set up like ours. It's not like, oh, they have a president and the president runs everything and like he's the guy. No, that's not how it works. How it does in fact work is there is a president, but the president is elected, you know, like Ahmadinejad was president before. He no longer is. But the president is elected, but the president still answers to religious leaders, the Ayatollah. So at this point, just keep that in mind. So all of these negotiations mean nothing unless the Ayatollah gives a thumbs up on it. If he says, okay, like, you know, it's cool, then they do it. But the fact is, the notion that Iran is shifting and willing to move a little bit and take on this 12-month breakout period and everything else shows a level of ability to actually negotiate, a willingness to negotiate, a willingness to make something happen in a more productive way. So to their credit, I think they should be, we should at least acknowledge that they are trying, and they've gotten further than they ever have in the last decade. Certainly further than Bush and Cheney ever allowed to go, even though in 2004, they could have done something. They just chose not to because they were in the middle of the Iraq War. They were in the middle of the war in Afghanistan, and negotiating with quote evil would look bad for them. So that's really fascinating in its own right. And that's a whole different story. Okay, here's another interesting part of this story. So one of the bits of the negotiation, besides the breakout period, which is clearly one of the biggest parts of it, some officials are saying that Iran has also accepted that in order to achieve this actual, you know, resolution or, you know, to end these negotiations on a positive note, they will have to agree to the reduction of nearly 10,000 centrifuges. It now operates and cut its enriched uranium production significantly. They also would have to agree to ship their stockpile of enriched uranium out of the country that they already have to ensure that the breakout period is met. So again, these are significant lines that are being drawn in the sand that are being presented to Iran that they seem to be willing to accept. And I think you have to take, look, you take it with a grain of salt. You don't just go, oh, okay, it's cool. Like they're willing to work and they're perfect. And now we can move on to something else and, you know, turn a blind eye to whatever's happening over there. I don't think that's true, but I do think you have to, in order to actually negotiate, you actually have to give a little bit and you have to take a little bit. And look, the six powers giving you a 12-month breakout period, that is them, that is their compromise. Do you think they wouldn't want it to be longer than that? Sure. But they have to give a little bit too. Now, the idea here is the 12-month breakout would give them enough time to say, okay, if they notice, because this would also include investigations and inspections of their facilities by, you know, international inspectors and everything else, like in every other country. For instance, France is a huge user of nuclear power. I think some of the most in the world. Japan has nuclear power. Now, we were in a massive war with Japan, and we even rebuilt their country, but we allowed them to have nuclear technology, even now. And I mean, obviously they do, because they had that terrible meltdown in Fukushima, which is still a problem, but you know, that's nor here nor there, but they do use it. And France, again, is a huge proponent of nuclear power. So they are all subject to international inspectors and everything to make sure everything is okay and copacetic and on the up and up. So along with this framework comes that, right? You're a nuclear power now, not in the weapons standpoint, but in the, as far as power is concerned, then you have to allow these inspectors in. And if things look shady or you're trying to enrich more than you were supposed to or something like that, if they find that information out, they have 12 months. They have 12 months to take action, to stop those situations instead of immediately going into a war, immediately becoming an aggressive situation where millions upon millions of people will die or be maimed. So yeah, this makes sense. And of course, Benjamin Netanyahu had plenty to say during his speech this past week about it in front of Congress or some of Congress. And one of the things from the White House, which was really telling and very interesting, is they basically said, yeah, that speech was all fine and good, but what are your plans? Because you don't have any, Israel. Like, you don't. They don't have let's go have a ground war with Iran solution. They don't. And they don't care to. But I'm going to talk about that in just a second. But that's this is the telltale sign, right? You have these countries that are trying to work out a negotiation, and then you have another country who is saying, yeah, no, screw all that. We got to take them out. They shouldn't have any nuclear power. We should have 200 nuclear weapons. That's right. That's what Israel has. 200 nuclear weapons. We should have those because we're us and they're them. So they get nothing. They get nothing. They get no benefits of nuclear power. Screw that. They get absolutely nothing. We have 200 nuclear weapons, but we'll be responsible, but they won't be responsible. So it's a very interesting bit of information. I am very not so torn on the whole idea of nuclear weapons and things like that in that part of the world. I think it's a powder keg. I don't think it's a good idea to have nuclear weapons of any kind. I don't think it's a good idea that any country in that region has them. But that being said, I find it wholly ironic that Israel has 200 and they are so freaked out the idea that Iran has one. And I'll tell you exactly why that is with this next story, which is, so Benjamin Netanyahu came to the United States 2 weeks before an election in his country for his position as prime minister. And so he gave this speech. He was invited by the Republican Party to give this speech. And here's the rub. The Republican Party did not, and specifically John Boehner, did not go to the president, did not go to the White House and ask, was this okay? And why does that matter? Because that has literally never happened in the history of the United States. It is the job of the president to welcome all foreign leaders into the country as far as, you know, giving speeches or some level of political anything. But they broke that precedent because guess what? There is just an unbelievable disrespect for the person who's in the White House right now. And you can call it whatever you want to call it, but I am amazed at the level of disrespect. I'm not surprised, but like I'm not shocked is what I should say. But I am amazed at the levels that they will go to disrespect the president. But going the other way, you better be on board and respecting the president and saluting and all this other bullshit when it's a Republican president. How dare you criticize or anything else? But they are the number one proponents of this nonsense when it's not their guy or woman in that seat. So what was the speech about, right? So let's break it down. I've got really sort of five sections on this speech. So what was the speech about? So the speech basically was Netanyahu getting up there saying, hey, look, Iran is very dangerous. It was funny because I personally found the speech to be disgusting in a lot of ways. It started out with Benjamin Netanyahu saying, listen, America, you're awesome. Oh, let me just fucking jerk you off for a little bit and tell you how amazing you are and how great of an ally you are and how great the president has been to us and everything else. He's like, oh, all right. So he's just playing to congressional ego and like, oh, yeah, we're awesome. We're the best. Yeah. Friends of Israel, blah, 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 all that. Right. And then it takes a quick shift to, now let me tell you why your president is wrong and why your president doesn't know what he's doing and why he doesn't respect us and why Iran is so dangerous and why we're so freaked out, because Iran is 7 minutes, 1 year, two days, 14 hours. I don't even know anymore. The numbers are just bullshit at this point. That's how far Iran is away from getting a nuclear weapon, and they're going to nuke Israel. Yeah, for 40 minutes or so, that happened. I mean, he got like an 8-minute standing ovation when he first came in from these Republican senators, 4 to 8 minutes, something like that. No president even gets that level of standing ovation. And I think that bothers me most. And I'm not even just saying like because Obama's a Democrat or, you know, somewhat liberal. No president gets that. You swore an oath, senators. You swore an oath to the United States of America, not to Israel. Know who your bosses are. So you don't pretend, or not even pretend, I think they believe it, that like Benjamin Netanyahu is like, oh, he's a real man. This guy believes in real America, blah, blah, blah. All this other horseshit. No, you swore an oath to the United States. Of all of the people that you should be respecting the most, the president, you don't. You allow this to happen. You allowed him to use Congress as the ultimate campaign tool in his country. Because here's Benjamin Netanyahu running for prime minister again. He's on television showing like, hey, look, I'm in front of the American Congress. Look how I control them. Look how I have them lapping up to me like a dog is what they did. Like a bunch of dogs. They were, oh, you're so amazing. We wish you were our president. I mean, that's how they were acting. I thought you loved America, conservatives. I thought you America was the best. America's number one. Why are you kissing at the feet of the Israeli prime minister like a bunch of bitches? I don't get it. So yeah, the speech was a bunch of nonsense, right? The speech was nothing more than a rehash of his 1991 speech when he was prime minister before, where he basically had some nonsensical drawing like, oh, yeah, or, you know, like, oh, look at how far away, you know, Iran is from getting a nuclear weapon. They're not close. They've been a year away since 1991, according to Benjamin Netanyahu. So that's why it happened, right? This was nothing but, as Chris Matthews said, and I don't always agree with Chris Matthews on MSNBC, but I give him 100% credit because he is absolutely right. It is nothing but a foreign policy coup done by the Republican Party, trying to take power away from the president over foreign policy to Benjamin Netanyahu, where he gets to tell the United States what they do. Fuck you. You don't get to tell us what to do. We tell you what to do, if anything. We're allies. We're supposed to work together at a bare minimum. We're not your lapdog. We don't go into whatever country that you point to and say, go blow that up for us. No, fuck that. You're not going to drag us into another ground war. You know, look, Benjamin Netanyahu, there's a video of him saying, oh, look, we got to go into Iraq. We have to destabilize Iraq. We have to take out Saddam Hussein. They have a nuclear weapon. They're going to attack Israel. Yeah. And we listened and we did that shit. What happened? One, no nuclear weapons, no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever. A horrible ground war where arguably almost a million Iraqis died. That's a number that you don't actually hear. Over 4,000 American soldiers were wounded, killed, and well over that were wounded, horribly wounded. Millions of people displaced in the area. You open the region up for groups like ISIS, and, you know, Al-Qaeda is like 9 dudes left, but, you know, they were able to prosper during that time. Listening to this guy is getting us into nothing but trouble. There's absolutely nothing but trouble. Why are people for it? Why are people against it? Like I said, the Republicans are for it because it seems like, oh, yeah, you know, you're sticking it to the president. They care more about hating the president than they actually care about the public policies and how they look. They don't give a shit about that. Oh, does the president look bad? Great. Great. That's all we care about. That's what we want. Screw that guy because he's a Democrat and he passed a healthcare law that we didn't care for because we were too goddamn lazy to figure out our own healthcare law over the last 20 years. So they hate him. They hate him solely because they do. Like, because reasons, right? Like, that's sort of their attitude. And why are people against it? Obviously, like I said, you know, you're not supposed to give a foreign leader an ability to use the United States Congress as a giant campaign for their country. That's a terrible idea. It's a terrible precedent. Also, look, I like to do this all the time because I think it gives you an interesting perspective. Reverse the roles. If there was a Republican president, say George W. Bush, and the Democrats brought in someone, Evo Morales, for instance, president of Bolivia, you bring in Evo Morales to come and talk before his reelection about how, you know, Bolivia is so great and it's so great under him and he's giving these warnings that we have to do this and blah, blah, blah. And then he gets to broadcast that to folks in Bolivia and they're like, wow, this guy is like, he's got the ear of the United States. Like, this guy must be top shit. We should reelect him. Look at his influence. You think the Republicans would be cool with that? You think the Republicans would be cool with Evo Morales sitting up, chewing coca leaves like he does? You think they would be cool with that? My guess is they wouldn't. So always reverse the situation and see how the other side would react. If it seems ridiculous, if you're on the other side or your ideology is on the other side of this, then it's probably just ridiculous. So, and then there's reality versus what Netanyahu said. Of course, Netanyahu says, you know, Iran again is 1 year away from having the bomb. What's interesting is Mossad, which is the Israeli equivalent to our sort of CIA, had leaked a number of times from some security cable leaks that Iran is not close to getting a nuclear bomb at all. They're like, yeah, no, we're doing espionage, man. Like, we're spies. We're looking out and trying to figure this shit out. And we don't see anything that they're doing to enrich uranium to levels that are under the, you know, to levels that are close to getting a bomb. Not at all. Meanwhile, you have the prime minister saying, yeah, absolutely, this is what they're doing. And you have Mossad folks basically saying, like, no, he's lying. Like, the prime minister is lying. The Likud party, which is the right wing party that Netanyahu belongs to, they're all lying. They're basically trying to push into a war. So if the CIA was leaking shit about our president doing that, you think that Congress would believe them? I bet they would. You know what? I actually believe Mossad here, because Mossad is one of the best espionage groups in the world, you know, or counterintelligence or intelligence groups in the world. They are. And they know what they're talking about. So my thought is you should probably believe them. If they're telling you this is what's happening, they're probably not bullshitting you. Okay, so from there, let's talk about the Supreme Court case that's pending right now for whether or not Obamacare, otherwise known as the ACA, Affordable Care Act, will actually survive. So this is unbelievably interesting. So the idea here is that there is a case in front of the Supreme Court right now called King versus Burrell, which is basically a case of whether or not there is these four words in the Affordable Care Act that actually show whether or not the Obama administration had intent or not intent to force the states into Obamacare, or whether or not they were giving them the option. So basically the conservative group that brought up this case is saying, no. Those four words, you know, established by the state. No, they meant that it was going to be, you know, established by the state, meaning, you know, the federal government, you know, like the United States of America, like the federal government, that's the state. And that forces those states to do that. And that's really not fair. And we're not okay with it, except for there's the letter of the law and there's also judicial intent. Right. So obviously that's not true, because there are states that haven't been forced to do it because they have chose not to do it. And that is their right. They don't get the subsidies because they haven't chosen to expand Medicare and bring in Obamacare. They're not being forced to. So there's this whole notion of whether or not that was their intent, right? Obviously it was. One of the things that's always brought up is judicial intent, like with the founding fathers, like, oh, their intent was X. You know, it's clear through these few things that happen, this is their intent. Because they're obviously dead, so we can't ask them. But the ACA was created just a few years ago, so you can ask them. And you can ask the framers of this law, what was your intent? And they all agree that the intent was to make sure that the subsidies are there for the states that want to opt in. So the whole idea here is if the ACA loses on this technicality or frivolous lawsuit, as far as I'm concerned, right, from the party that supports tort reform, please. If the case swings against the Affordable Care Act, then 7 million people will then no longer be able to afford insurance, because those states would lose those subsidies from the federal government, because the law would be basically, it wouldn't be struck down, but it would basically be a knife in the heart of the law. Like, it would destroy it. And what would happen is those 7 million people would likely lose their insurance. That's it. Overnight. Game over. Now, this is being debated and everything right now, and they're pretty much trying to figure out what to do, because they have basically till June or July to sort of figure this out. Now, for me, I don't think there is a question as to whether or not it should be, whether it should pass or not pass, or continue as it should. Obviously it should. You know, like I said, the framers are there. You can ask them. The intent was clearly to make it an option, right? Obviously the states are enticed to do it, because if they do it, then they get a lot of state cash or a lot of federal cash, and they're able to cover more people in their state. It's like a win-win, really. But the notion of they don't want to do it because, the reasons Obama's evil or a tyrant or whatever bullshit they came up with, that's the reason why a lot of those states don't do it. The states that have done it, more than three dozen states, are basically reaping the benefits of actually having tons of people insured. But, facts don't really matter. It's more about ideology, right? So there's a number of really interesting parts of this. Most of this has to do with the fact that the Republicans don't have an option. They don't have any option if the Supreme Court kills this. So that's really scary, right? So, okay, on one hand, you have the Republicans saying, all right, yeah, no, we totally support killing the law. Okay, that's fine. Well, what's your alternative? We don't have one. Oh, okay. Then that's a really bad move, because dropping 7 million people off of their insurance overnight would be a disaster. It would be an utter disaster. But far be it for facts to get in their way, right? Over ideology. So someone, during the proceedings, in the Supreme Court, the Obama administration lawyer, his name is Don Varelli, was going back and forth with Justice Antonin Scalia, one of my least favorite people of all time. And Antonin Scalia says, quote, "You really think Congress is just going to sit there while all the disastrous consequences ensue?" He's talking about, if we strike this law down, do you think Congress is just going to like twiddle their thumbs? Look, Don Varelli, you're my new number one hero. His response, he goes, quote, "Well, this Congress?" And the audience in the courtroom started laughing. And Scalia says, yes. He says, "I think Congress would act." "Well, I don't think you're right, Antonin Scalia. I know you're an amazing judicial mind. I think you're a raving lunatic and an asshole. But that is an aside. No, I don't think Scalia, I don't even think Scalia believes that, by the way. I don't think Scalia believes it one iota. I think Scalia knows that they won't act. And I don't think Scalia cares. I think Scalia thinks that it's better to be a goddamn ideologue, as he's been his entire time on the bench. I think it is, his feeling is, it's better to be an ideologue and go with my gut on how I feel about things, to actually help people, than to actually pull people out of poverty, to actually stop people from going bankrupt due to medical expenses and things like that. I don't think he gives a damn. He's got a job for life. What does he care? He could die on that bench as far as he gives a damn. So, no, I don't think he cares, not one iota. I think he's being completely disingenuous that he thinks that Congress is going to do something. Horseshit. They're not going to do anything. So, let's talk about that, right? So I'm not just making that up. It's a real concern for Republicans, because while they're super happy that they might get the law struck down, they're super scared that the law might actually get struck down. It's one thing to campaign against something. It's another thing to govern, right? It's easy to say, oh, Obamacare is oppressive and it's evil, blah, blah, blah. Not that any of that is remotely true anyway, but it's so much easier to campaign on that than to actually come up with an idea and to actually run on something. Because running on something means that people can judge you. Criticizing something and being a bomb thrower from the sidelines is an easy thing. This is the reason why you'll never see Sarah Palin run for president. It's so much easier for her dumbass to stand on the side and lob bombs and go, oh, Paul Revere on that horse and Obama's the devil, and just lob a bomb onto the news than to actually run and to run on her own and run on her ideas. You can't, because if you have to run on your ideas, you'll get crushed because your ideas don't make any sense. So here's an interesting quote from someone who did not, this person is a Republican health policy aide who didn't want to go on the record so that he could speak candidly. That tells you something right there, right? Quote, it's an opportunity that we are talking about creating a healthcare bill of their own, the Republican, like a viable healthcare bill. Quote, it's an opportunity that we failed at for two decades. We've not been particularly close to being at the same page on this subject for two decades. So this idea, we're ready to go. Actually, no, we're not. They're terrified. Are you kidding me? Here's a guy or woman. I don't know. Here's a person who is involved in coming up with the healthcare policy, and he's telling you they're not ready. They have 5 months. How the hell are they going to come up with something they couldn't get together in 20 years? Now, remember, not only do they have to come up with something, that's one thing. Like, oh, okay, yeah, we came up with something, we didn't come up with something. Not only do they have to come up with something, they have to come up with something that covers a number of people, at least come somewhere close to covering as many people as the ACA does, keeping costs down, and they can't use a mandate because that was the thing that they ran against and they pushed so hard against. So you can't replace it with the same thing. You can't, oh, well, we have a website too. But you got to get insurance now. You can't run on that because that's the one thing that you said you wouldn't do. So they're screwed. They're so fucking screwed. I love it. It's awesome. It's awesome because it goes to a point that will be made on this show and that I make when I talk about politics all the time. They are so good at politics. They are so bad at policy. The Democrats are so bad at politics, and they're pretty decent when it comes to policy. They are. They're not great, but they're pretty decent. And they crafted a bill. While it has issues, at least it worked. They don't have anything on the Republican side. They have nothing. Oh, let me guess. Vouchers, credits again, right? Yeah, the thing that doesn't work. The thing that we have found doesn't work. But what they do is they run the same thing. They're the Sam Brownback on the federal level. Cut taxes. It didn't work. Cut them again. Didn't work. Cut them again. Didn't work. Cut them again. We're at 0%. Start giving out money to rich people. I don't give a shit. Just do it. Because I'm an ideologue, and I'd rather be an ideologue than to actually be a statesman or stateswoman and actually do something and make it work. Maybe you have to go against what you said before because it's the right thing to do, but they don't do that. Because they're ideologues. Look, as much as I think that George H.W. Bush was not that great of a president, and I think he screwed up a lot of things, him getting burnt on saying, I'm not going to raise that, no new taxes, and him getting burnt by the Democrats on that, because that's what he lost on. Frankly, it was bullshit. And it was a thing that Democrats should have never done. But they had to, because they're dumb at politics. So they figured, yeah, we nailed them on that. We won the re-election. Yeah, and now you've created a monster where Republicans are never willing to raise taxes. And George W. Bush raised taxes because the country needed him to. But that's not talked about enough. It's always talked about is how he didn't keep his word. But he didn't keep his word for the right reason. And this is the same with these guys. Is they're not willing to break their word for the right reasons. Why? Because they're ideologues. They're not statesmen. They're ideologues. So from there, there's this whole idea of like, like I said, they can't run and they can't run on bringing an individual mandate again because they're screwed. Senator Lindsey Graham, who is a big name, obviously, you know, in the Senate, he's the Republican from South Carolina. He is always involved in any top negotiations for things like this. He told Talking Points Memo that he would even support the Wyden-Bennett healthcare plan from 2009 if the court gets rid of the Affordable Care Act. Oh, okay. That's not bad. Except for the Wyden-Bennett plan has a mandate. So did you even pay attention before you said it? They just say shit. They don't pay attention. They just say it. And someone goes, oh, well, why don't we go to the Wyden-Bennett plan? Yeah. It has the same thing that the Obamacare plan has because the mandate is necessary in order for you to get enough people in the healthcare pools so that you distribute the cost, that you lower cost for everyone. But they don't want to do that because, again, they are ideologues. They are not statesmen. Another Republican aide says, one big challenge is that the GOP plan would be unlikely to cover as many people, making it an easy pinata for the Democrats. Quote, the brutal truth, we have a problem with that for very specific reasons. We don't have good responses. Show me the constituent in a town hall meeting who you can tell it's okay for them to lose their health insurance. Did you hear that? They know that they can't cover as many people as the affordable healthcare plan can and currently does. They know that they can't. But they're willing to jump off a cliff solely so that they can say they got a win against Obama. That's it. And the Democrats. That's it. They know they can't cover it. What is going to happen? Let's play out a scenario here. Where the ACA loses and it's gutted, and 7 million Americans overnight lose their health insurance. You think Americans are going to remember that the Republicans did this? You think so? I don't think so. I think they're counting on that. I think that the general public doesn't remember shit. They don't remember anything that didn't happen 2 minutes ago. So the Republicans will come out, they'll let it die. They'll sit back. They'll come up with some nonsensical rule. They'll lose 2016 because of it, right? But then the Democrats or whoever the Democratic president is will have to fight even harder to try to fix this and get the ACA back, which will be next to impossible because they don't have the Congress for it. And then 7 million people will continue to have failing health, failing access to the things that they need, and people will literally die. There is your actual scenario. That is a real world scenario. People who couldn't afford to go to the hospital, couldn't afford to get checkups, people who couldn't afford to do preventative care and things like that will die because you are unwilling to maybe the things that you have a problem with, you're not willing to work with the Democrats. You're willing to destroy it. Okay. We'll see how that works out for you. One of the other things that I thought was really interesting is here is Tom Miller is a healthcare policy wonk for the GOP. And Tom Miller says that his idea would be for, now listen to this. This is his Republican plan. Now, granted, other Republicans don't agree with him. So this isn't like, oh, okay, this is their plan. No, they can't even agree on a plan amongst each other. Right. So you really think that they're going to get a plan together in 5 months? OK, sure. But here's what Tom Miller would like. Now, I think this is textbook the Republican Party. So it's interesting. He says that he has an idea of a tax credit, ding, 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 mechanism, which could be income sensitive, age adjusted, or a flat dollar amount. He wants to block grants to states and reforms to exchanges. Of course, none of those things are going to get support. Are you kidding me? You want to block grants to the states so you can pay for it? No, people are not going to buy that. Also, notice that they want to make it income sensitive, age adjusted, or a flat dollar amount. What is the thing I told you with the Sam Brownback thing, right? There it is. There it is on a federal level. You ready to get your $10,000 and then that's enough? That's it. You got it. You're welcome, everybody. Now get out of our face. The poorest people in the United States are the ones who suffer the most as far as medical issues, because they can't afford preventive medicine. They can't afford, when they do get sick, to go to the hospital. So they just suffer at home and things like that, right? Oh, you know, I've been smoking for 20 years. I have emphysema. You know, I get hurt on the job. You know, they won't pay for it because I don't have health insurance and blah, blah, blah. These are the people who need it the most. Look, I have great health insurance. As I told you earlier, I have great health insurance, and I can, through my insurance, I can afford to get sick. I can afford to have, you know, my surgery for my shoulder. I can afford to have those things. Not everyone can afford those. And when you're talking about a flat dollar amount, and look, that might as well be in bold letters, because that's where they're going. If they can just cut out all the bullshit and they're just like, oh, give you 10 grand and just shut you the hell up and we just move on, that never grows. That's just $10,000. And maybe even over time, we drop it to 8 when you're not looking during a non-election year. Then maybe we drop it to 5 when you're not looking. Another non-election year. Yeah, that's where they're going. I guarantee it. If there is a Republican plan that is put in place, or not put in place, but is offered, right? Because they refuse to tell you, the actual GOP refuses to come out with what they want to do, right? Because they haven't hashed it out yet, obviously. If they come to a conclusion as to how they want to do this, if they make it public, you mark my words right now, that will have an absolute flat dollar amount that you get every year. I guarantee it, because it is the easiest thing for them to save money and to push the cost to the American public, and to wash their hands of it like fucking Pontius Pilate. Like, yep, we gave him 10 grand. Oh, you got even sicker? That's not my problem, man. Look, this is America, Jack. Pull yourself up by your bootstrings. It's not our problem. Guarantee it. So, it is. It's amazing. Here's another thing. Avik Roy, who is a conservative healthcare policy wonk, quote, prefers an approach is to use the ruling if they got Obamacare. He proposes legislation to keep the federal subsidies for all states with one caveat. They can choose between setting up an Obamacare-style state exchange. Okay, so we're all good. Like, all right, it's not bad. Remember, there's a caveat coming. So they can choose between setting up an Obamacare-style state exchange and a more deregulated exchange, potentially free of rules like forcing insurers to accept customers with pre-existing conditions or provide a minimum package of essential benefits. Those essential benefits that they're talking about are the plans that that Obamacare got rid of because they didn't cover enough, right? So that was, you remember that whole thing about like, oh, you can keep your insurance and everything will work out. And the Republicans were like, there are people who are getting kicked off their insurance. See, Obama's the devil. He's the worst, blah, blah, blah. That's because those people's insurance plans didn't meet the minimum requirements of the Affordable Care Act. Like, oh, you're supposed to cover this, or you're supposed to cover, you know, 4 eye exams a year or something like that. They didn't cover those things. They were worse. So they culled those out of the ACA so they wouldn't offer them. So if you had that insurance and you signed up for Obamacare, you couldn't have that insurance anymore. You had to choose another plan with better minimums. There's a thing that you won't hear in the mainstream media. It wasn't that they were getting booted off because like their insurance was so great. It's because they didn't have the bottom was so bad that they needed them to get higher and they wouldn't. So, yeah. So here's this guy. This is his plan. I'll read it to you again. He wants to keep all the subsidies. He wants to keep all the federal subsidies so that it seems like they didn't make any changes. But more deregulated exchanges. So they will have the option to do the Obama-style state exchanges that are there right now. So the progressive states will continue to have those because they won't be stupid. But the red states will go with the more deregulated ones that are free of the rules of, you know, no pre-existing conditions, all that other stuff. And what does that create? That creates a culture of, one, shitty provided insurance, terrible levels of insurance, and it provides cover for the Republicans. Notice that, remember what I said, the Republicans are really, really good at politics and really bad at policy. This is a really good at politics thing because the average American won't know that this all passed. What they'll say is, well, our state set up the exchanges and I got booted off for pre-existing condition and, you know, my insurance sucks and it's expensive and all this other stuff. Obamacare sucks, but this isn't Obamacare. This is a different thing. That's why I said they're great at politics. They're not good at policy. And you can't argue their hustle because that's a fucking genius move. It's a genius move, but that's what they're doing. And don't be surprised if that part of that comes up, but pay attention to these things because these policy wonks, these are the guys who are going to make those decisions. And so their decisions are going to become proposed law 100%. So they have a third option, right? Like, so the first option is come up with their own plan, which you've heard their ideas, disaster, disaster, disaster. Nobody wants that. Their other is to work with the Democrats to fix the law. But if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. You think they're going to work with the Democrats? They see them as the enemy. They're not going to work with them. No, of course not. Get out of here. That's not even an option. Please, please. Third option, let it burn. Let it burn option means they do nothing. That means that 7 million people lose their insurance. Three dozen states lose their federal subsidies, right? That's the 7 million people who lose healthcare. So they'll have to seek waivers of some sort through Medicare or something like that, right? So that increases those costs. The insurance companies would be forced to raise prices because they would start to lose so many young people that joined up on the ACA, but it's gone now. So they would lose them and they would go back to a bunch of young people not having insurance. Cause hey, I'm healthy, man. I don't need insurance. I did that when I was young. I was young and stupid. Luckily I didn't get burned by it, but there are a lot of people who go, yeah, I'm not going to give them money for health insurance cause I'm 25 and I'm doing just fine. Insurance is for old people, man. I don't have to worry about that. So insurers would have to raise the price because there would be less people in the pool to lower the price, as I said before, because young people are there. There was a super influx of young people and they're healthier. So the insurance company doesn't mind having all of these people in their pool, right? Because they're not using the health insurance. So they're like, oh, it's fine. So they can distribute the cost and lower for sick older folks. Because they get sicker more, young people don't. So it balances itself out, right? So everybody's sort of helping everybody else, right? This is a part of living in a society. So if they lose their customer, if they lose those customers, those young folks, because they bail because they're still healthy, then the cost goes up. But then because the cost goes up, the other people who are already on the insurance can't afford the insurance, so they bail. So they lose even more people. So the 7 million people who lose insurance might cause even more people to lose their insurance because sheerly by the setup, because they're going to crush one thing and it is a domino effect. Understand what that means. You could lose 10 million people could lose insurance. 10 million. That's unbelievable. Based on what? On ideology, not based on facts, not based on helping people, not based on doing your goddamn job, which is to protect the citizens who elected you. Not based on that, based on ideology. So yeah, I mean, it is amazing what they're willing to do. It is amazing what they're willing to do, all on the basis of ideology. All right, so next up is This Week in Wackadoo Politics, which is, I think, one of my favorite sections. These are just bizarre political stories from this week. And so if you hadn't seen it, you really should. You should go watch the video of Ben Carson, who is going to run for president. We talked about him last week. Obviously, very famous neurosurgeon. Ben Carson talking about how, you know, being gay is a choice. And it's obviously a choice because people go into jail straight and then they come out gay. Okay. I feel like as a surgeon, you don't understand how humans work, but that's fine. Like, whatever. I don't think you have a chance of being president at all. You're nothing but a goddamn token. Yeah, I said it. I'm black and I find you reprehensible. And I think you either you believe the things that you're saying, which makes you an idiot, or you don't believe them because you think somehow being a black conservative is lucrative for you, for your career and for your speaking fees. And if that's the case, I find you repugnant. So I don't know, six on one hand, half a dozen on the other, as far as I'm concerned. So that all being said, and everyone was making fun of him, and he even came back out and he says, oh, you know, they cut up my response and blah, blah, blah. No, they didn't. They didn't. They asked you a question, you responded, and they showed the entire response. That was it. You said that shit. You got screamed on by people, even conservatives, who were like, what are you doing? What are you, an idiot? And so he came out and said, I'm just not going to talk about it anymore. I'm just not. I'm just going to stop talking about it. Okay. Why don't you just stop talking about everything? You just shut up and go away. But also, you're running for president. You don't get to just not talk about topics at your leisure. That's not how that works. You're not ready for prime time. But that's not why I'm bringing up this story. I'm bringing up this story for two amazing quotes by Dan Savage. Now, Dan Savage is the host of the Savage Love podcast, very famous, you know, sex podcast. He's also a gay rights advocate. He's gay himself, obviously, but Dan Savage is a beast. Look, I need conservative Republicans to just look. You see Dan Savage coming, you cross the street because you're gonna get brutalized. Because not only is he a great advocate for gay rights and just socially liberal rights in general, but he is super smart. And he makes an argument that I'll give you the quote in a minute that I had never heard that I thought was absolutely great. And I think it's a quote, or you can paraphrase it as you see fit, that I think everyone should use because it's genius. But so in talking about the Ben Carson thing and how, you know, you choose to be gay. Right, Ben. Like, when did you choose to be straight? I don't know about you, but I didn't choose. I don't remember a time when I chose to be straight. I'm straight because I'm straight. But hey, maybe it happened for him. I don't know. Maybe it did. But so what's interesting is here's a quote from Savage. Quote, if being gay is a choice, prove it. Choose it. Choose to be gay yourself. Show America how that's done, Ben. Show us how a man can choose to be gay. Suck my dick, name the time and the place, and I'll bring my dick and the camera crew. And you can suck me off and win the argument. Come on, man. God damn. That's awesome. Yeah, you can choose to be gay and then choose not to be gay, right? So why don't you just blow that dude and prove it? Oh, wait. Because you would find that to not be something you'd be into because you didn't choose it because your brain goes, I don't want to suck dick. Yeah. Okay. That's fine. Neither does my brain, dude. Doesn't mean you have to be a bigot against people just because they're not like you. So one, I found that quote to be hilarious, but this is the quote I think that everybody should really pay attention to because it is the one that is the most devastating, for people like Ben Carson. Quote. Now remember, Ben Carson is saying that being gay is a choice. Quote. No one has to serve in the military and no one has to get married. People have control over whether they marry or enlist, right? And yet, like religious belief, both are covered by civil rights statutes, and people like Ben Carson don't object. The only time you hear that a trait has to be immutable in order to qualify for civil rights protections is when they talk about the gay. Yeah, that is a perfect comment. It is a perfect quote. Because he's right. And I never thought about that because that's always the argument. Oh, well, it's a choice. So what? It still should be protected. Okay, you say it's a choice. Whatever, that's fine. Look, that's a dumb statement anyway. But here is a quote that breaks that down. You believe in your religion, that's your choice. You're religious, that's your choice. You join the military, that's your choice. You get married, that's your choice. And those things are protected by the federal government to make sure that you are treated equally. And that is a fantastic point. And it's a strong point. And it shows that Dan Savage is not one to be messed with. So good on him, man. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. All right, so the last... but certainly not least story in the wackadoo politics of the week stories is there is a Republican in Kansas. He is the Secretary of State in Kansas and an all around moron. His name is Chris Kobach, and he has a radio show. And he was talking about a decision. He was having a discussion about the University of Minnesota's decision to stop including race and other physical descriptions in email alerts about campus crime. Right. And so, okay. I mean, look, I mean, part of that is kind of weird. Like, if it's campus crime, then I think you should. I mean, I guess if it's after the fact, then I don't think it really matters as much. But maybe, like, I'm not 100% against you saying, like, yeah, there's a black dude going around punching people in the face. Like, did he do it? Yeah, okay. Well, then he did it. Just because he's black doesn't mean you shouldn't say it. At the same time, don't just say, you know, don't fearmonger based on their race or based on their physical description, because I have a tendency to believe that that's probably what's happening. You know, like, black people are a menace on campus. Like, that's... No, don't do that. That's a terrible idea. But if it's a specific thing, I don't have a problem with that. So I don't know the whole background of that, but that's not why I brought the story up. But I just wanted to point that out. So somebody calls into this idiot's radio show, this guy named Stu, and says, yeah, look, man, I think that basically I could see a scenario where Obama is, that he'll put in laws to say that you cannot prosecute minority races. On what planet is that possibly true? So apparently, look, as a black guy, I'm about to be in the best situation ever that I can't be prosecuted for crimes. Good. It's about time. I have paid my dues. It's about time I get to have a crime spree where I can just do what I want. This is going to be amazing. Except for that will never happen in the history of anything, because that's ridiculous. So here's a quote from Kobach. He says, quote, he was not going to be enforcing them to the benefit of white people, talking about laws, to the benefit of white people who were discriminated against on the basis of their race. So that's basically what you've described. No, that's not true at all. Since when have there been any laws, one, made by the president? Do you even know how Congress works? Do you really think the Republican Congress, the Senate and the House, is going to pass a law that says, yes, black people can't be prosecuted? Like, you believe that? Mitch McConnell, Orrin Hatch, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, he's in that group. He's not white, obviously. But you think these lunatics are going to say, oh, yeah, okay, Mr. President, we definitely agree with your ability to not prosecute minorities. On what fucking planet, dude? What are you talking about? The caller also said that he did not think he was nuts for envisioning a future where black people could not be charged with any crime. And again, Kobach agreed. With any crime. Any crime. Just black people can't be prosecuted. Again, what fantasy planet do these people live on? Again, I can't wait for this to happen. Oh, it's going to be awesome. Join me, other minorities, as we begin our crime spree, because we will not be prosecuted under the bullshit, crazy thought process of this lunatic who is the Secretary of State in Kansas. These people exist for real. Amazing. So, yeah, my hat's off to you. I thought that the Ben Carson thing was the craziest thing I'd heard this week. Not by a long shot. That's easily the craziest. So, yeah, look, if you're black or a minority of any kind, look, sharpen up those knives, man. It's going to be, what is it, the Purge? Yeah. Go all day. But it's like the Purge, but forever, and white people aren't allowed to have guns, I guess. I don't know. We take their guns, and then we have a bunch of crimes and, like, beat them up and everything. And then Obama's just, like, sitting in the White House with gold chains on, smoking a stogie, saying, like, my plan has finally come into fruition. Amazing. So, there you go. All right, that is it for me. We'll be back, or I'll be back, or we, who knows, next week for another episode of Look Forward. I hope you enjoyed the solo show. Let us know. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/lookforwardshow. We're on Twitter at lookforwardshow. Follow us there. Send us a message. Did you agree? Did you not agree? What are your thoughts on things you talked about? What are some topics you'd like to see? You know, leave those on our Facebook page or Twitter as well. Of course, remember to get in those 5-star reviews. As long as they're 5 stars, I will read them. Even if you say things that are not 5-star worthy. Even if you say, oh, George W. Bush was the greatest president ever. Obama's the devil. 5 stars. I'll read it. And then I'll laugh, but I'll read it. All right. We'll see you guys next week for another episode of Look Forward.